Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Kast. Glad you're with us. We're going to talk about health costs and health insurance today. A new study by PricewaterhouseCoopers Health Research Institute predicts health care costs will rise by 6.5% in the coming year, driven by increasing cost of medical services and drugs and by higher consumption of health care. The federal government estimates that 20 million Americans have gained health insurance coverage since the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was passed in 2010. About 6 million of those 20 are young adults who are now permitted to remain on their parents' plan until they're age 26. Plus, almost 13 million people are insured through the state and federal marketplaces. And still, about 9% of the U.S. population has no health insurance. Today, a look at the rising cost of health care. Who is being hit hardest? Will costs continue to rise at increasingly steep rates? I'm joined by Margot Sanger-Katz, healthcare correspondent for the New York Times site The Upshot. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Midday, Margot.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
It's very nice to have you with us. And with us here in Studio A is Dr. Peter Bielenson, president and CEO of the Maryland Insurance Co-op, Evergreen Health. In its third year, Evergreen has about 40,000 members. Before founding Evergreen Health, Peter Bielenson served as Howard County Health Officer from 2007 to 2012 and as Baltimore City Health Commissioner from 1992 to 2005. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Margot, premiums, deductibles, out-of-pocket costs, all rising. What is driving these increases?
So there are a couple of things that are driving them. The main thing that I think we're going to see a change in next year is really about premiums. So the Affordable Care Act limits the amount that deductibles and other kinds of out-of-pocket costs can rise. So a lot of the plans that are being offered on the Obamacare exchanges are sort of already maxed out in terms of those kinds of things. But premiums are going up for a few reasons. One is just, as you said, the cost of medical care is going up. So, you know, the typical cost for insurance companies to pay doctors, hospitals, and drug companies for medicines and for treatments is just more expensive next year than it was the year before. There also are some regulatory changes that are happening, and the details are a little bit technical and boring, but the bottom line is that the federal government had been helping out some of these plans in the early years, kind of giving them some training wheels to get up and running since it was a new program. And now that we're a couple of years into this new program, they're taking those away. And so that means that these insurance plans have a little bit more financial risk than they did before, and so they're charging higher premiums to compensate for that.
I want to bring this home to Maryland a bit. Looking ahead to 2017, the Kaiser Family Foundation studied 14 major metropolitan areas, including Baltimore, and it found that Baltimore should expect a dramatic increase in the type of plan on the exchange that many people who were not eligible for subsidies buy, the second lowest silver plan premium. Kaiser Family Foundation thinks premiums will rise 15% in 2017. That would be nearly triple the 2016 increase. A 40-year-old non-smoker who now is paying $249 a month would pay $287 next year. Peter Bielenson, why such a marked increase in rates locally?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, as Margot Sanger-Katz was mentioning, what she was referring to were the three R's of the Affordable Care Act: risk adjustment, reinsurance, and risk corridor.
We can
talk about them. But two of them, to stabilize the market, are going out: reinsurance and risk corridors. So that was sort of a backstop to insurers if they had excess costs from taking on people with pre-existing conditions and the new requirements of the Affordable Care Act. So that's part of the reason the costs have gone up. In addition to the increase in medical costs in general, pharmacy costs are a huge, huge issue, particularly the new medications for cancer, for hepatitis C, all great medications, but very expensive. They've gone up 40% in the last couple of years, so that's driven up the costs as well.
And are those, I'm thinking of the coverage, Margot Sanger-Katz, of the drug for hepatitis C being very expensive, but is it widely enough prescribed that it has a market increase on everybody's premiums?
Yeah, so those hepatitis C drugs are quite expensive. The good news about them is they're quite effective. So in almost all patients who take these new expensive drugs, they actually can cure their hepatitis C, which was a condition that was very hard to treat before and that caused a lot of sickness and other kinds of complications and other kinds of long-term health care costs. So those drugs, you know, the good thing about them, they're expensive, but they seem to work pretty well. The sort of bad news is that they're very expensive on a per-patient basis, but also there just are a lot of Americans who have hepatitis C and who are in need of this kind of treatment. And so we could see the year that the drugs were introduced, actually overall health spending in the United States actually blipped up just a little bit just due to this drug, one drug alone. So I think hepatitis C is something that's going to cause some ongoing costs. I don't think it's necessarily a source of year-over-year increases. I think, you know, we sort of had that increase a couple of years ago, and now it's just sort of built into the health system that some patients are going to be treated every year for this disease until it's, the numbers go down. There's one other factor that's leading to higher premiums that I didn't mention and that we probably should talk about, too.
And what is that?
And that's that, you know, this is a brand-new market. So when insurers first came into the market in 2014, they had to basically make an educated guess about what it was going to cost to insure people who came into the market. And, you know, what seems to be clear around the country, and it looks to be the case in Maryland, too, is that a lot of the insurance companies just made a mistake. They thought that the people who came into this market were going to cost less money than they turned out to cost, and they lost money in the early years that they were in this market. And so, you know, part of what we're seeing with these big requests for increased prices for 2017 is sort of a market correction where the companies now have a couple of years of experience and they see, oh, you know, these patients are actually a little bit sicker and more expensive than we expected. We lost some money in the early years and now we need to raise prices to make them more in line with the actual cost of taking care of these people. So that's obviously bad in the short term. You know, if you're someone who's looking at a 15 or 20% price increase, you know, that's a big hit to your pocketbook. But when we think about the long-term stability of these markets, that's not necessarily a bad long-term sign, because once the market kind of the prices get in line with what the cost of these products really is, then we would expect that the year-over-year increases are going to moderate again. The fact that they're going up a lot for 2017 does not necessarily mean that every year we're going to see these kinds of big increases.
That is Margot Sanger-Katz of the New York Times site The Upshot. She covers health, and she's speaking to us here on Midday on WYPR. Here in this, I'm Sheila Cast. Here in the studio with me is Dr. Peter Bielenson, the CEO of the health insurance co-op Evergreen Health in Maryland, former health officer of Howard County and former health commissioner of Baltimore City. You are an insurer now, even though your company is a nonprofit, but I'm sure you're looking carefully at the dynamics of premiums in Maryland. What do you think of the analysis we just heard from Margot, that this is a course correction, we got to digest it for this year and next year, and then we probably won't see these percentage increases?
I think it is a course correction. Part of the reason that things are more costly than I think insurers thought originally is because there are not as many younger, healthier folks have gotten in as were expected, particularly with the tax penalties, which are now fairly significant. The thought was that that would incentivize people who are young and healthy to decide, for example, instead of paying a $900 tax penalty,
For which they get nothing.
Which they get nothing. For $1,300 or something, they can get some decent health coverage. They might as well go with that. But that is not happening quite as much as people thought. Let me just push back a little bit on hepatitis. So we have 40,000 members, $80 million in this past year in premium revenue, money coming in from
premiums.
You're
talking about Evergreen Health Co-op.
22 hepatitis C patients cost $1 million of our $70 million, $75 million in claims paid. One out of every $75 was due to 22 people out of 40,000. So it is actually a significant portion of our health care costs.
You're saying you don't need very many insureds, very many customers who need that coverage for it to really affect your
right.
payout picture.
It actually is several dollars per member per month in terms of costs.
That everybody is paying,
right.
All your members are paying. Listeners, you can be part of this conversation. Have your insurance costs gone up? How much of your budget is going to health care costs? Are there one or two prescriptions that are eating up your own health care budget? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Margo, I want to throw another question into this mix, because I think a lot of us read and heard when Obamacare went into effect that because it was going to have such an emphasis on preventive care, that people's health would improve, in that, you know, the first year or so, there would be people who had not been taking care of themselves who would come into the insurance system, and they might be expensive to care for. But that, you know, as it clicked in, preventive care would hold down costs. Doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think two things. One is, I think it's a little bit soon to really know the answer to that, because there are a lot of people still who are uninsured or who are relatively new to insurance. And, you know, to the degree we're going to, like, get any benefit from preventive health care, it might take a little bit longer to really see those effects. But to put that to the side, I do think that this idea that giving people preventive health care is a big money saver in the long run is a little bit of a common fallacy. And, you know, it's worth kind of unpacking why that's true. In general, people who don't have insurance, they are very unlikely to go to the doctor for any reason at all. They're only going to go if something is really seriously wrong with them. And, of course, when that happens, the care they get is quite expensive. But we know that almost all prevention that we do requires giving the same service to lots of healthy people, you know, testing them for a disease or treating them with a preventive medication or something like that, giving them a cancer screening test. You have to give that to lots of people who are essentially asymptomatic or close to asymptomatic, even though we know that only a very small percentage of those people are going to ultimately come down with the disease and have these very expensive downstream costs. So there are lots of really good reasons why we should prevent illness and we should do these kinds of tests on the general population, because it's really important for their health. You know, you want to be able to catch cancers early or prevent heart attacks by giving people who need them cholesterol-lowering drugs. But the idea that this is going to save money for the overall healthcare system, there just doesn't seem to be very much evidence of that at all, because it does cost money to give these preventive services to all of the people who end up ultimately not needing them. And as medicine becomes more advanced, this may not continue to be the case forever. We may get more and more targeted in identifying who we're going to give certain preventive services to, so we don't have to give them to lots of people who won't benefit from them. But the way it is now, whenever sophisticated analysts do these studies, they find that almost everything that we consider to be really worthwhile mainstream preventive medicine actually costs more money than it saves.
Dr. Bielenson?
That's certainly true with things like mammograms and colonoscopies. I think that the preventive services also include regular primary care visits, or at least one primary care visit a year, where you can get information and messages that can prevent all sorts of things from happening, talking about smoking cessation, about changing your eating habits, your physical activity habits. That, again, it costs the system money that's not being paid by the insurance company. Because it's a free visit, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But there are benefits to preventive care besides picking up the relatively unusual cancer from 1,000 screens. You get 4 cancers. That's true. That costs more money. But the preventive services that you're offered by your primary care physician or nurse practitioner can sort of be lifestyle changing things that can prevent things down the road. Could actually save money in the long run.
And which would not carry much cost, except that just
the
overhead cost, right, of arranging that conversation.
Correct.
And hoping it takes root.
Correct.
We need to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the lawsuit that insurance co-op Evergreen has filed against the federal government. We'll hear why they're challenging a policy intended to reduce risk in the marketplace. You can be part of this conversation. Did you sign up for Obamacare in this last enrollment period? Are you worried about expected increases in rates? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about rising healthcare costs, from premiums and deductibles to prescription drug costs and co-pays for doctor visits. I want to talk about the lawsuit that Evergreen Health has filed against the federal government about the risk adjustment program that's part of Obamacare. Dr. Bielenson, I'm not sure I really understand it. What I picked up from the news coverage is that Evergreen Health is going to be billed several million dollars, a payment most of which is going to go to CareFirst, which is the largest insurer in our market. And my head exploded at that point, and I thought, someone has to explain this to me. So
So
What's going on?
I'll explain it in brief. Risk adjustment, again, is one of the three R's of the Affordable Care Act, which was meant to stabilize the marketplace because no one knew how many sick patients were going to come in, how many healthy young people would stay in, et cetera. So it's sort of as a backstop, they had these three R's. Risk adjustment, in theory, makes sense. It basically says that in a given state, all the insurance carriers add up the risk scores of their members, which I'll get to in a second, and the sicker the population of an insurance carrier compared to a healthier population of an insurance carrier, that healthier insurance carrier pays money as a risk adjustment to the company that has sicker patients. Kind of makes sense because you don't want to incentivize people to only go for the healthy folks, right? And so they thought that you'd leave the small companies with the bad risks, the sicker patients, if you didn't do this kind of a risk adjustment. Risk adjustment is scored by every single person in a given state by their insurance carrier. So, for example, I have Parkinson's disease. I would score like a 2.9 compared to a 1.0 average person. You might be very
healthy.
This
is, let me make sure I understand. So my insurer is supposed to report a thumbnail number that describes how risky I am, how likely I am to incur medical costs, basically.
Correct. Based on a diagnosis made by a doctor in that calendar year, which is where the rub occurs. So that makes some sense, okay? You figure out how risky the general population is of Evergreen versus Kaiser versus CareFirst, and the healthier companies pay the sicker companies, okay? The problem is it's hugely skewed, and it's based solely on capturing these codes from doctors' visits. So
a new company like Evergreen is fairly new,
is very disadvantaged because CareFirst, for example, had me for 10 years. They knew I had Parkinson's disease. They knew full well in 2015 they better get me to a doctor to get it diagnosed again in 2015 to make the code, if you will. Evergreen didn't exist prior to that. So there's this informational imbalance where there's no way we could have known who to go after. Secondly, we're very fast growing, and most of our members come in the last third or quarter of the year. So again, if I join Evergreen in November, which is in fact what we did, and I didn't go to a doctor for November or December, I appear as completely healthy, not with Parkinson's disease. Third, they don't allow pharmacy data, which would make a big difference because insulin, for example, if you have insulin prescription and you don't see a doctor, that should still be able to
code you a clue
that you have diabetes, but that's not allowed in this process. There are a whole range of very fatal flaws of this methodology, the bottom line of which is that the companies that actually do the hard work of trying to keep people well, as we do, and I could talk about our diabetic program down the road if you wish, along with the Kaisers of the world, who also do a lot of proactive preventive services, end up paying the behemoth $22 million from our coffers, which is 26% of all premium revenue that we get this year. In other words, 26 cents of every dollar that a member pays us, Evergreen, to help keep them healthy and give them quality, affordable care, gets taken away and given to CareFirst, who, as you probably know, is in trouble in D.C. for having too much surplus. Meanwhile, Kaiser is paying them $30 million.
I should point out that CareFirst has declined to discuss this topic because it is in litigation now, or it's a subject. You're actually suing the government.
We're suing the government.
Margo Sanger-Katz, are you hearing this kind of thing from other co-ops? I understand of the 23 co-ops that were set up under Obamacare, more than half have collapsed already. So there's only, I think, 11 left.
10.
Are you hearing about this problem elsewhere?
I think the co-ops are suffering from, quite a few different kinds of problems, both these sorts of, regulatory concerns and also just some kind of basic financing issues. And again, as I said before, I think because these co-ops were the newest to the market, I think some of them were the most likely to make pricing mistakes in the beginning and then sort of lose their shirts. I do think, it's just important to understand these exchanges or marketplaces in the states. This is a brand new market for what is essentially a brand new product. I mean, it is health insurance, and there are lots of people who have expensive experience making health insurance products, but this is a new kind of product. There's a lot of new rules. These are customers who have not had health insurance, a lot of them, before. And so I think you almost have to think about it like any other market in which there is a new market and in which there are a lot of startups. You know, most startups in most industries fail, and co-ops are a kind of startup. So in some ways, I think there are some regulatory concerns and there are some financing concerns and sort of particular policy reasons why the co-ops, so many of them, did not succeed. But I think it's also important to recognize that in a good, kind of healthy, well-functioning market, you expect there to be some winners and losers. And so the fact that some co-ops have gone out of business is, again, not necessarily bad news that the market is broken or that the regulation is broken. I think it's just a sign that, you know, some of them were more successful businesses than others. I do think the kind of issues that, you know, Evergreen has raised about the kind of technical details of how some of these risk programs work are interesting and, you know, are probably worth exploring more. It will certainly be interesting to see how this particular lawsuit works out. But I think overall, when we think about the failure of a lot of these co-ops and the failure also of some for-profit health insurance companies, I think it's worth seeing that some of them, it's probably because of some policy troubles, but a lot of them, it may just be the normal kind of tough competition that happens when you have a market-based system where not everyone is going to survive.
Well, I must push back a bit. First of all, we're profitable, as are several of the co-ops. So we are actually, if we survive, which we are certainly intent on doing, we will be able to repay the federal loans that occurred. I would say that the rules are terribly skewed towards the large pre-existing insurers, predominantly because of the lobbying that went on during the Affordable Care Act debate that was going on. And it's not just the co-ops. It's a lot of other small, new, often for-profit insurers who are also being hurt very much by these regulations, which are not just technical but are really substantive. And so what you're going to end up with is what's antithetical to the point of the Affordable Care Act. That one of the main points of the Affordable Care Act was to encourage increased competition, innovation, and disruption in the marketplace. And by eliminating a lot of these small, new insurers, and combined with the mega merger that's going to be happening or mega mergers that are going to be happening, you're actually going to have the reverse of what the Affordable Care Act wanted. You're going to have one or two major companies on the marketplace in each health marketplace in the states, which will drive up costs, which will end up in a death spiral, destroying the Affordable Care Act, because then the young and healthy will absolutely not participate because the premiums are going to go up. So I would argue that it's a very important issue, the risk adjustment issue, to the small insurers in the state of Maryland and in the country in terms of the Affordable Care Act actually surviving.
I should say that in the coverage that I have read, I have the impression that both Maryland's health insurance commissioner and the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare agree with your basic arguments, but the timeline that the federal agencies have for adjusting it is several years out.
Actually, we're fighting CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They have now agreed with exactly what we had pointed out, some of the things that I was talking about, including pharmacy payments, et cetera, but not till 2018. Our insurance commissioner, Al Redmer, who's from the Hogan administration, has been phenomenally supportive, wanting to see a true free market. And by the way, talking about marketplace, as that there are winners and losers in the marketplace, I should point out that the insurance lobby, when the Affordable Care Act was debated, made sure that our federal money that we got from federal loans to set up the co-ops could not be used for marketing. So it's not an even playing field.
That is Dr. Peter Bielenson, the CEO of the Maryland Insurance Co-op Evergreen Health, here on Midday on WYPR. With us on the line from Washington is Margot Sanger-Katz of the New York Times site, The Upshot. And we're talking about health care costs and why they're going up and what impact it's having. We have a call from Vinnie DeMarco, who heads Healthcare for All here in Maryland. I think when we were talking about preventive care, Vinnie wants to talk to us about a new campaign announced just this morning called A Breath of Fresh Care. Am I right, Vinnie?
Yes. Thank you so much, Sheila, for having me on. And first, I want to just commend Dr. Peter Bielenson, who, first of all, was our founder of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, Healthcare for All. coalition. I want to, just on behalf of the coalition, commend him for the great job he's doing at Evergreen. That they're surviving and thriving is wonderful. And I know Fargo gave a lot of reasons why maybe some survive and some don't. But one of the reasons Evergreen is surviving is Peter's smarts and commitment. So we commend him on that. What I wanted to talk to you about for a minute was just this morning, I was at the Maryland Hospital Association headquarters where we joined them in launching a new campaign called the Breath of Fresh Care. And with me and Carmela Coyle, the head of Maryland Hospital Association, was Gerald Stansberry from the NAACP and Hank Greenberg from AARP and Young Invincibles and faith leaders. And we were talking about this new way that we're all working together to get the message out to the consumers and patients that it's really a new day for healthcare in Maryland, and that hospitals are now incentivized to work with the community to keep people healthy. So there's a website, breathoffreshcare.org, that people can go to where in one place they can find out all that's going on in every hospital in the state to keep people healthy and out of the hospital. And we're going to have forums across the state in the fall, starting in September 14th in Baltimore City, where people can come and hear about this. And we talked about an exciting new program we're working on called the Faith Health Network. We're piloting it with Lifebridge Health, Sinai Northwest, and Carroll Hospitals, where we're bringing faith congregations together with hospitals to keep people healthy. And it's working very, very well. And our goal is to expand it all around the state this year. So that's what I want to say. Thank you for the opportunity. I don't know if you have any questions about it, but it's the breathoffreshcare.org, and it's a very exciting new way to make health system transformation work in Maryland.
Vinny, thank you for telling us about it. We will look at it further. Breathoffreshcare, all one word, .org is the website. Thanks, Vinny DeMarco from Healthcare for All.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
I would like to take an email we got from Terry in Baltimore, who says she is a State of Maryland employee concerned about what these increases mean for state employees. If they only get, as a cost of living increase, maybe 2%, and insurance costs go up 10%, she'll never get that raise. And Margo Sanger-Katz, what about that? I mean, is that essentially what we are looking at because healthcare costs are going up significantly more than inflation?
I think this is a really great point, and it's actually a sort of nice moment to step back and recognize that while these new Obamacare marketplaces are new and they're important and they are providing insurance to lots of people, and especially people who couldn't get insurance before, they really represent the minority of people in our healthcare system. Many, many more people are getting their health insurance through their jobs. Like a state employee who gets their insurance through their jobs. And the factors that are affecting what's happening in that market, some of them are the same and some of them are different. So the sort of good news if you're a state employee is that some of these regulatory details that we were talking about and some of these questions about pricing mistakes in the early years, those don't affect you. The employer insurance market's been around for a long time. The companies that are in that market have been doing it a long time. There's a little bit more stability in that market. And so there are almost always increases in the cost of employer insurance, but those increases have more to do with the sort of overall medical inflation, like how much more it costs to take care of people in the medical system, than they have to do with some of these other issues that we've been talking about. That said, it is definitely the case that over, almost as long as we can think about through American history, since we've had health insurance, that the rate at which the costs of providing health care to people have gone up have exceeded the rate of inflation, and in the last few decades have also exceeded the rate at which people are getting raises. And so, that does create a lot of problems. It creates this squeeze where, either employers are handing out smaller raises because they're having to use all of their pay money to offset the cost of insurance, or we see a lot of people who are being asked to pay a higher percentage of their premiums out of their own pocket every year. And then the third thing we see is that the kind of insurance that's being offered to people from their jobs is changing. So more and more Americans have to pay deductibles or other kinds of high out-of-pocket costs, where their health insurance that they got through work in past years might have covered them, you know, from the first dollar of care or very close to it. So it is absolutely a legitimate concern that the rising cost of health care in this country is sort of squeezing out people's raises, and in some cases, in some years, it completely erases them or even overtakes them. So
let me let Dr. Bielenson get in on this.
Yeah, so the Affordable Care Act did several good things. It increased access to insurance. It did insurance reforms like keeping people with pre-existing conditions from being excluded. But what it really did not address was bending the cost curve, as they were saying before. In order to do that, you have to deal with the payment system and get away from fee-for-service, which is a perverse incentive to do more testing, do more seeing more patients, et cetera, et cetera. Instead, get towards payment reform like capitation or a global budget like Vinny was just talking about. And secondly, really encouraging evidence-based practices, which means encouraging people to provide services that actually evidence shows makes a difference in a human being's life. So real quickly, and we have a minute for...
Take a minute, and
okay.
then we'll
here's a perfect example. Value-based insurance design, VBID, boring name. But what it means is, in real life, we have a plan in Evergreen that's unique in Maryland and rare in the United States, that for a diabetic patient that's in this plan, they get all evidence-based practices, glucose strips, insulin, lab tests, foot doctor visits, eye doctor visits, endocrine doctor visits, primary care doctor visits for no out-of-pocket costs, no deductible, no copay. And the reason for that is because evidence shows that that will keep people healthier and actually regress their diabetes. And that's actually worked in our primary care offices to a 35% reduction in healthcare costs for our diabetic patients and a 50% reduction in hospitalization for our patients. That's the kind of thing that needs to be pushed through the Affordable Care Act to control costs, because otherwise the costs are going to continue to rise, and we're already at 18, Margo knows this better, 18, 20% of our GDP is spent on healthcare, and it's not sustainable.
And Margo, before we take this next break, is there a simple way for those of us who don't cover this day in, day out, as you do, to get a sense of is the kind of evidence that Peter Bielenson just described, is that actually seeping its way into the system? Is evidence becoming a stronger factor in how medicine is being practiced?
I think it is and it isn't. And I also think there are other factors besides the ones that Dr. Bielenson talked about that are leading to some of these cost increases. Maybe we could talk about those more after the break. But part of the problem is that we pay really high prices for healthcare in this country, and those prices rise a lot. So the amount that doctors and hospitals get paid for services is also quite high. I do think that there are efforts on behalf of health insurers and the Obama administration to try to push the whole system into a more kind of value-oriented direction where some of the unnecessary or overly expensive services are used less. But I think there is this underlying problem of price, particularly for people who have employer-based insurance, that we have to keep our eye on too.
Okay, let's take this quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about what is pushing healthcare costs up and how the players in the system are trying to cope with that, and also what some ideas are about changing the system yet again. This is Midday on WYPR. You can be part of the conversation. You can call us with your ideas at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Margo Sanger-Katz, healthcare reporter for the New York Times site The Upshot, and Dr. Peter Bielenson, president and CEO of the Maryland Insurance Co-op, Evergreen Health. We were talking before the break about the way components of costs are hitting different people. A recent report by PricewaterhouseCoopers finds that more employers are switching to high deductible plans, plans with lower premiums and higher deductibles. One out of four employers surveyed already offers only high deductible health plans to their workers, while another 39%, almost two out of five employers are considering switching to that in the near future. Margo Sanger-Katz, the increases we've been talking about, who do they hit most?
You know, these increases in deductibles, it's they're very broad-based at this point. A lot of people who get insurance through their work have deductibles now, and those deductibles are typically over $1,000. So it's not a small amount of money to ask people to pay when they get sick. We also see people in these new exchange plans. Almost all of those plans also come with relatively high deductibles of, you know, $1,000 to several thousand dollars a year. And it is a real change in how health insurance works from a couple of decades ago, where people would just go to the doctor and the health insurance would pay their bill. The good thing, at least in theory, about deductibles is they're supposed to encourage people to be a little bit more prudent with their health care dollars. You know, maybe if you never have to pay anything when you go see the doctor or you go get a medication, you just won't care whether you really need it or whether the thing that you're getting is a good value. And so there's this idea that if you attach some financial pain to that choice, then people will be a little smarter. Maybe they'll shop around for a lower cost service of care, or maybe they'll decide, you know, maybe I'm going to give this cold another day or two and see if I feel better before going to the doctor. And there is very good evidence that when you put a deductible on a health insurance plan, it reduces the amount that people use the healthcare system. And so that leads to lower premiums, which, you know, in many ways is good. But there also are problems with these rising deductibles because they do give people a lot of financial exposure, and that can be really scary for people, especially people who don't have a lot of savings. We did a big survey in partnership with the Kaiser Family Foundation at the end of last year, and we found that, you know, about 20% of Americans, even with insurance, had difficulty paying their medical bills, and that many of them were having to make really difficult life choices in order to pay those debts, you know, things like moving in with a relative or running up a credit card bill or cutting back on sort of basic necessities, not buying Christmas presents for their kids. You know, we just heard a lot of really wrenching and personal stories from people about what happens when you have an unexpected illness, you get this big bill, you have a high deductible, and you don't really know how you're going to pay it.
Do you hear those same kinds of problems?
Yeah, we absolutely do. It's an issue of health insurance literacy. Most people, no matter what their socioeconomic class is, don't really know how health insurance works. And so what Margo was talking about is, especially on the exchanges, many people went for what was basically the sticker price, the lowest sticker price, or
the premium.
So for $200 premium, a couple may be able to get an insurance plan that has two $6,000 deductibles. So you're basically paying 200 times 12, 200 times 12. Oh, my God. Whatever,
200
times 12,
4,200,
$2,400 a year. Sorry,
$2,400
plus the $5,000 plus the $6,000 deductible, maybe twice because you and your spouse may have that. So you're paying $8,000 a year before you get any coverage.
And that's not what you were expecting.
That's not what they were expecting. And to the point that a large insurer in the state of Maryland who did those predominant plans in the first year saw that 30 to 40% of their members were falling off the rolls by September of that year because they weren't getting any benefit. So we actually offer much more comprehensive plans at Evergreen that may have a little bit higher premium, but actually are for people who have chronic diseases, for example, makes much more sense to do.
We are hearing in this political year proposals for revamping the Affordable Care Act. House Republicans, led by Speaker Paul Ryan, have put out a plan that would expand health savings accounts, offer tax credits to subsidize the purchase of private health insurance, and allow people to buy insurance across state lines. Margo Sanger-Katz, I'm not asking you to assess the political expectation of whether this plan will actually become a piece of legislation. At this point, it's just a plan, and there aren't very many costs attached to it. But is it expansive enough to be a serious contender if it is proposed?
In some ways it is. I think that this plan from Paul Ryan's office is the most comprehensive proposal to replace the Affordable Care Act with something else that we've seen from the Republicans. You know, since the health law passed, and even before, we've been hearing promises that they would repeal the Affordable Care Act and then they would replace it with something better. And there have been very few details about what that replacement would look like. So I do think that the Ryan plan should get some credit for being reasonably comprehensive and clear about what it would do. There are, as you said, a lot of still unanswered questions. You know, details really matter, the kind of regulatory details that we were just talking about how risk scores are assigned to individual patients and individual health plans. Those things really matter in terms of, you know, how well the system is going to work, and there's nothing even approximating that level of detail in the Ryan plan. But the other thing to understand about the Ryan plan is that it would create a healthcare system that is very different from what we have right now. It would be extremely disruptive. And it may be that some people will think it would be a better system, but it would be much more of a change than what the Affordable Care Act did to our system before. So just a few things that it would change. One is that the Affordable Care Act really focused on trying to provide health insurance to relatively low-income people who didn't have access to health insurance before. And it seems pretty clear that the Ryan plan would take away those options from people, and it would not replace them with something that would be affordable to many of them. So you would see a higher rate of uninsurance among people of low incomes who either have access to Medicaid through Obamacare or who are getting very generous subsidies that help them buy plans on the exchanges. The other thing is that health insurance would probably be a lot less comprehensive. The Affordable Care Act set up all kinds of regulations that said if you're going to offer something, you're going to call it health insurance. It has to adhere to a whole laundry list of rules. And some of those rules have come under criticism because they say it drives up the cost of health insurance to have so many rules about what health insurance can include. But in an environment in which there were none of those kinds of rules, there would be a lot of incentives for insurance companies to remove some of the layers of financial protection and some of the kinds of health care coverage in their plans in order to be competitive on a price basis. So those are just some of the differences that we would see with these two plans. The other really big one is that it would get rid of the employer tax exclusion. So that would mean that a lot of employers that currently offer health insurance to their workers because there's a huge tax advantage in doing that some of them might decide not to do that anymore and would instead say, hey, you know, you can take this tax credit out into the individual market and purchase your own plan instead of me paying all this money for you to get it through the employer system. And so when some similar proposals have been made in the past, particularly during the McCain campaign, the presidential campaign in 2008, there were a lot of estimates about how many people who had employer insurance would probably lose it. So again, that could be better. You know, maybe it's better for everyone to have their own health insurance plan that's portable. If they change jobs, they don't have to worry about changing insurance. But it is a big change from what we have right now.
So some big changes proposed by the House Republicans. And meanwhile, the likely Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton has a plan to expand Medicare to allow a buy-in for people 55 and older. Now Medicare is offered to people 65 and older. Her offer would be to people 55 or older who do not have employer coverage. Peter Bielenson, do you think that's feasible? What kind of changes would that make in the system?
It's feasible, although there are some issues with the required benefits of the Affordable Care Act that aren't covered by Medicare. I actually must say that I had supported a single-payer system for the last 20 years, and so it's ironic that I run a health insurance company, although we obviously work partner with primary care offices, et cetera. But I'm actually more for a single-payer now than I was before because I've seen the immense amount of middlemen and middlewomen that are pulling off large chunks of administrative costs from every different insurance company around the state of Maryland and around the country as well. And I think we have two single payers in the United States right now, the VA and Medicare. They work quite well. There certainly are problems with them, but they work quite well. They're equitable. They are comprehensive. They are much less administrative overhead. And I think that's probably the way that we're going to end up going. We cannot continue to spend 18 to 20% of our GDP on health care costs that are relatively out of control. And we need to have a much more equitable system than we currently have. And I think that eventually in the next 10 to 15 years, we'll end up with a single-payer system, not government-controlled doctors, nurses, and hospitals, but the payment coming from the government, as Medicare is.
Essentially,
Medicare for all.
Medicare for all.
Right.
We've got just a couple of minutes left, and I don't know whether either of you have any suggestions for what people who are struggling with the system we have now, what could people who are struggling, what can they do? Margo, are there some things that you've noticed in the system that people aren't making sufficient use of that might actually help them cope with
Well, I would say that if you are someone who is in this new exchange market or you're someone who is currently uninsured, I would definitely encourage you to take a look at the choices that are available to you and to perhaps connect with a professional who can help you assess your options. There are people called navigators or connectors, and those are people who are really trained to look at health insurance and give you advice about how to think about the different choices that are in front of you. I mean, buying health insurance is really, really difficult. I mean, even for very educated people who have a lot of experience, I get requests from my colleagues at the New York Times all the time. Can you look at these plans and tell me which one is better? It's just really hard. This is not a shopping decision that many Americans are really well equipped to make. So I definitely encourage people, like, go out and look at your options and try to get someone who's really an experienced professional to help you think about it. And, you know, especially for low-income people and in a state like Maryland, many of them may be eligible for Medicaid and not realize it. That's a program that would require them to pay no premiums and very little out-of-pocket spending. And so it really could be quite good insurance with very little financial exposure for them.
So comparison shop, put some effort into that. But Dr. Bielenson, you were pointing out to us earlier, and Margo just said as much, it's hard. I mean, it's not an activity that anyone would choose to spend a weekend doing.
Right. I agree completely with Margo. Health insurance literacy is what she's talking about, and we believe at Evergreen it's one of our mission statements to serve the entire population of Maryland, whether you're a member with us or not. And so we're actually putting out a simple to understand Health Insurance 101 that will be available online and in print July 1st to go over exactly these types of issues.
That's Friday. Next Friday.
Yep.
And what do you think you can tell somebody that they don't know that's going to be life-changing?
You need to look at all aspects of out-of-pocket costs. It's not just the sticker price or the premium. In fact, that's probably the least important part of their health insurance costs. It's how much co-insurance there'll be, what is covered and what is not covered, what has a copay. And you need to look at your health, your general health of your family members to see whether you should have a high deductible, like let's say my 28-year-old son, who basically needs catastrophic care, so he might get a cheap plan that has high deductible, as opposed to someone who has a chronic condition like myself, who clearly is going to go through spending the entire deductible, but pay a little bit more premium to have a low deductible that would cover more comprehensive care.
So you think people can actually sort this out better, perhaps, than we have been?
I think so. It's not like Travelocity, which is the exchange that
the comparison
the president made. It is way more complicated and nuanced than that. But it can, if you have the information with the navigator's help, for example, it can be solved.
Well,
we do have a long way to go. You know, the healthcare system is just not consumer friendly. It's really hard to find out what things cost. It's really hard to find out who has high quality or low quality. It's often hard to find out which doctors and hospitals are covered by a given insurance plan. I think, you know, the future is that all of those things have to get easier so that consumers are not feeling just adrift in this complex, expensive system.
You have given us a lot to think about, and I'm grateful to you both. Margo Sanger-Katz, healthcare reporter for the New York Times site The Upshot. Thank you. And Dr. Peter Bielenson, president and CEO of the Maryland Insurance Co-op, Evergreen Health. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers on their menu. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Some Muslims say their community is at a greater target for hate crimes and prejudice than it's ever been, even after 9/11. Islamophobia is our topic tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.